In other words, for the next 5 decades at least, probably in the next 5 decades, we have the 2 viable sources of electrical generating capacity. And that is to either burn hydrocarbon fuels or to go nuclear, that is to go fission, and then the regular fission reactor that I described this morning, and then breeder reactor. Right now, they're the only 2 viable sources of any quantity. And so we have now reviewed that, and we are really building up so that the social scientists and all and you can then sort of have some basis for evaluation. But you're not quite there yet, because you have to know not only what we have, but what is the risk, I guess. A lot of people are involved today in cost, benefit, risk. And in setting up for risk analysis, this is very treacherous ground, because we do not have a great deal of information to go on. We have a considerable body of information relative to the effects of irradiation. And I'm going to review a bit of that for you now and try to put it in perspective for you so that you have some basis for judgment. Because many places, including Minnesota, you are very concerned about having nukes in your backyard. And you're not satisfied with the limits set by the AEC, and so you've lowered the limits. And so I'm going to talk a little bit, I thought, about, well, I thought it might be useful to talk a little bit about radiation effects. And I introduced you to a few new terms this morning, and I'm going to introduce you to a few more now. And that has to do with radiation dose. Most of you know what feet are, gallons are, and candle power, perhaps, and decibels. Well, I'm going to introduce you to Röntgens, or rads, REMs. They're all equivalent, relatively speaking, for your purposes. But we're not going to talk so much in REMs, but in millirems and maybe microrems. A millirem is 1/1000th of a rem, or a milliröntgen is 1/1000th of a röntgen. And I'm not going to define this physically for you, but to give you a handle on it from your own exposure. And to give you a short course in radiation biology. Here, I had this on here just to test out if I can read from back of the room, and I found out I couldn't read real well. But you see that in 1965, the coal looked pretty big as a source of power, and will be probably burning even more coal to satisfy the electrical demand in the United States in 1980. But you see that nuclear, which was very small here, has suddenly become very large. Now, you can challenge me at any time, and especially now on clarification of some of what I'm going to tell you about radiation dose. I don't know, blue, you like blue? Is that one of your favorite colors? It matches my baby blue eyes. Does that show? If I draw it right on this place, I guess it'd show up. All right. It might be useful to go, let's start at, we can start at 1R, Röntgen equals rad equals rem. This is exposure measured in air. This is this amount absorbed in soft tissue. And then this, gives consideration to the effect of a given type of radiation. For example, I talked about neutrons today, and they are considerably more effective per Röntgen than, say, just the X-ray you may be exposed to. All right, Now, biologically speaking, we cannot really show an effect from a single exposure of one rectum. You can detect it. You can detect in certain systems. If you do electrical potential readings, say in the frog eye, and expose that frog to radiation up to maybe less than one rentgen, maybe a continuous thing, a few millirentgens per few seconds or a few minutes, and you can see a change in electrical potential, but you can never see an effect with that. For a long time, we thought you couldn't detect radiation, but there are certain lower forms that will move out of a high radiation field. A snail, it might arouse certain animals. We kept saying that you couldn't see radiation. Yet, a Frenchman collected a bunch of people and put them inside of a darkened room. And he had an X-ray machine on in this room that he could turn on and off without you hearing when it was on and off. I'm not so sure who he had in the room. Maybe it was Algerians, because it was during that time. But anyway, he told these people to look up there. And then he'd turn the machine on, and certain signals he'd say, is it on or is it off? Well, they had their light, they were accommodated, and they could detect this irradiation. But generally speaking, you can say you cannot see it, feel it, or taste it. So one R, in fact, there have been experiments where we've given one R per week to mice and really haven't shown an effect over their lifespan. Another experiment I can recall in mice, John Gowan at Iowa State University at Ames, Iowa, gave 1 to 2 R every day. This is a continuous radiation for 22 hours a day for a total of 1 to 2 R per day. And then as soon as they got old enough to breed, he'd breed them, and they were continually then, he'd just take them to breeding age, and he went through, when I visited him many years ago, I think he was in 20 generations, and he couldn't really see an effect by this, at this level. All right, let's see what kind of exposures you may have. All right, if you have a chest X-ray, if the machine is a good machine, and they're using good film, you know, like General Electric machine, and I used to work for General Electric, and Kodak film. Perhaps you'll get by with a tenth of an R for an X-ray of the chest. If you have a full mouth X-ray, you may take 1 to 5 R to the mouth region. In the old days, not too many years ago, they did not cone down, and so you'd have an exposure about this big. So there are a lot of children in the United States today who were exposed a couple of times a year, because I talked to a lot of dentists who would not examine the child until they'd had a full mouth X-ray, and I asked them, how often do you do it? And I would do it twice a year. And so they were taking radiation dose of about up to 5 R twice a year in this region. When our children were growing up, what was a hot item then was to check their shoe fit with fluoroscopy machine, which was a real bane. And what kind of radiation dose did you get there? Well, there were probably exposures of 40 to 50 or more R. Now, this is soft irradiation, but you know the gonads of the child aren't very far from the floor and the source. So you're talking a rather substantial dose there. Now, that was only partial body. One of the radiobiological principles, or several of them that are important, are the intensity of the radiation, that is, whether you take it in one sitting right now or spread it over the whole lifetime makes a lot of difference. For example, when I started in nuclear industry in 1948-9, I was allowed to, as an occupational limit, I was allowed 3/10 R per week. This has been lowered somewhat, but I was allowed 3/10 R per week. And if I would have taken that limit, which I did not, but if I'd have taken that much for every week, then I would have taken 15 R per year. Or if I'd have been at it for 30 years, I would have taken 450 R. Now, had I taken this whole limit at one sitting, it could have done me in, you see. But if I took it at 3/10 R per week, chances are I wouldn't look any worse than I do now. Now, what about effects? Well, for any of you here, if I had been following your white count, and that's a sensitive tissue, your white blood cells, if I'd been following it so I knew about where your pattern was and you weren't under too much stress, because it varies a good deal of stress, and I exposed you to, say, 30 or 40 R, why, I could detect a slight drop in your white count very shortly after this exposure, and it would recover. Now, if I exposed everybody in this room, say, to about 150 R, 100 to 150 R, many of you would be sick. You'd feel ill. You would have nausea and vomiting. If I told you that you got it ahead of time, you know, I says, now you're all going to get 150 R, probably all of you would be sick. So it has that element. Now, as I showed you some slides the other night, and we looked at maybe 350, 400 R range, and that kind of a dose will kill half, if given acutely, will kill half of the people within, say, 60 days. If you go up to 1,000 R, probably it'll kill everybody, half of everybody, except probably the Norwegians. not the Norwegian. All right, but 1,000 R will even get the Norwegians. In fact, 1,000 R will get most all of the mammals. It's a lethal dose for most of the mammals. There are a few exceptions. It'll also get pine trees. They're unusually sensitive, which is surprising. Yet a lot of life forms, like there's a wasp, and a lot of the beetles and wasps and stuff. I know one, Habrobracon, 80,000 R will lengthen its lifespan. What really happens, it kind of slows it up, you know, so it doesn't live as fast. There are certain bacteria that live in a swimming pool reactor. And that's why when you use radiation for sterilization or pasteurization, for sterilization, for example, if you sterilize your bandage or many of your drugs today, and this is a routine procedure in many areas, you have to go to millions, maybe a million or two or three R, to be sure that you got everything, because some viruses may live through maybe a million R. So you have that great range in sensitivity. But it is interesting that the mammals are down in here. What are some of the other exposures for a fluoroscopy of the, if you're having trouble, your wife's nagging you and you've got a tummy ache, or for other reasons, for lack of faith, you have an ulcer or something you think you have. So you go down and you have a fluoroscopy, the GI series, you may take, you say, 15 or 20 R. So I hope that kind of gives you a handle on this, so you can know what we're dealing with. And if there's any questions as we go along, just don't hesitate to ask them.
This Hiroshima and Nagasaki, how far away from the bomb blast was
the question is what was the exposure, and I have to go by, I'm going to recall something here. The question has to go Hiroshima, Nagasaki. The radiation dose was different, a little different in each place. Within 500 meters was not a good place to be. Even 1,000, within 1,000 meters, I think you're talking here from ground zero. Somebody who may know more about this can correct me, but this goes out to, I think probably at the limit here, maybe there was 50 rad, but out to 500, you're talking maybe 200 to 300 R if you were not shielded by something. And as a result of it, those within 1,000 R here, or 1,000 meters, they showed about 100 times increase in leukemia incidence, which was not observed out at 3,000 meters or beyond. And the dose out here, I don't know, maybe it was 5 or 10 at this line, something like that. Now this was, of course, it was a Model T kind of a detonation device. It was only 20 kilotons, and it was an air burst. It's really quite hot.
Are these cumulative?
Or, all right, are the effects cumulative? Well, that's an important question. I'm probably going to run out of paper. No, I'll just do like this. I can tell you about some of the radiation effects. Now, I just told you that if I took 450 R right now, I'd probably die. There have been some interesting, but also that if I took 3/10 R per week, that it isn't like filling a bucket, that there is recovery. And the kind of experiments we do in animal medicine to prove this is that, let us say there is a lethal bound here if you plot radiation dose, R dose right here. And this is a lethal bound, let us say it's 500 R or something for this given mouse. It isn't quite like this because in certain mice and other animals, it varies, but you can usually say the young are more sensitive. There are some exceptions to this. In one strain of mice used by Lindup and Rutlett in England, the dose falls to at weaning time, and so that it takes less to kill them at weaning than it does at birth or later in life. And then the lethal bound goes up like this, and then it falls off so that it takes less out when you get very old. You get what I mean? I told Patricia as well, that 28 days that you show here is at weaning time. That's a great stressful period. And I remember when I was weaned. No, I really don't. But it was a very stressful time. But we'll draw a straight lethal bound. And so what we do split dose kind of technique. And we'll go up here and we'll give a radiation dose. Hi, man. We'll give a radiation dose up to, say, maybe in this case, 250 R. And then we have enough animals in it so that we go up to time, this is time T, and maybe T plus 1 day or whatever it might be. And then we find out how much more radiation do you have to add to get them to die. Is that all right? And if there were no recovery, you would only have to add 250 more, right? Out here. In reality, you can then determine the shape, you can determine the shape of the curve. You have enough animals. And lo and behold, the curve goes like this. In fact, in some animals, it goes like this. I remember in some swine, it took 165% for a while of what it took originally, of what it took for the controls. But eventually, you assume a new pattern. But generally speaking, you probably assume a new line here, which is what we call an irreparable fraction. In other words, there is a residual, but there is considerable recovery. In fact, I could give a lethal dose to some animals here, such as mine, and wait a period of time for recovery to take place. Say I give them a dose that killed half of them, or a third of them, or something. And then I have those that recovered, and we nurse them along, and say 6 months out, I could invite you in and say, all right, tell me which ones were irradiated. hard for us to do it. But there is some irreparable fraction, so that the net result is that they die sooner. We did a study in beagles. They did a study in beagles, and we've done it in a lot of other animals too, but they did it in beagles at the University of California before I arrived. Well, the animals, some of them were still alive in a cave. And the pattern of their lifespan looked something like this, and it's kind of interesting. They radiate them when they were young adults or near puberty. And then you just plot survival. And let us say this is a typical survival curve of you and a lot of other people. I mean, a lot of and animals. And sort of goes like this, and the last one dies out here. And this, of course, shows you that, you know, no two are quite alike. No such a thing as an average, as we learn about today. Now, that's the control, say. If you go out to 9 years here, you see that that maybe 70% are still alive. Now, another group had a 100R. And here's their curve. And when they got out to 9 years, they said, are you sure you turned on the x-ray machine, you know? It's the same number alive there. But they had, because it started to fall off, and they generally died sooner as a mean. 300R, which is a LD50 for a dog, they had a different pattern, and they were sort of like this most of the way. And the net result is that for 100R, you have probably a 6% shortening of the lifespan. Now, this brings up another very interesting and important subject, which I must tell you about before we go any further. In making assessment of effects, there are very few people who understand biological effect versus dose, the dose-effect relationship. And in biological and biomedical sciences, we often plot a biological effect versus a dose. I don't care what you talk about. Whether it's aspirin, salt, or any of the chemicals, or in case of radiation. Let us take just a soft irradiation for you to cause a redness of the skin. In the old days, they used to quantitate radiation dose by the erythema dose, the dose that would cause redness of the skin. And then you get to that point and you say half of that is a half of an erythema dose and so forth. Well, if you give a certain dose and you can increase the dose up here and you can still see no redness, but eventually you get to a point where you do see redness and then it goes up in a sigmoid kind of fashion and not sort of linear, and then you can get just so red, you know. So it goes over like this. The same goes with your white count. I mentioned that white count is very sensitive. But you can't really see an effect on white count by peripheral blood counts here. But if you work up here, I mentioned 30R a little while ago, you might see an effect right here. And then you go on up here, and you can really wipe them out with a certain dose, and then it sort of flattens out. So, and this is true in chemical toxicity, but you usually have a sigmoid curve. This is sort of a general statement. Now, there might be a few isolated cases where you might have approach linearity or linearity for a time. Now, this is the thing that's bugging a lot of people in setting limits. And I'm a member of the National Council on Radiation Protection. This is made up of 65 people in the United States who sit on, it's not a governmental body, it's an independent body that evaluates the data and more or less sets the limits. Now, some members of this NCRP also sit on the ICRP, the National Committee on Radiation Protection of the world, and they look at the data and set these limits. Now, in setting the limits, we figure on linearity to be conservative. By that I mean this, and most of the studies that we are done up at the higher levels, because you can't show an effect with a reasonable number of animals down here. So what happens is that you take an effect here with a rather fairly high dose, you drop back a little further, and maybe you get this percentage effect, you see? And maybe you get another effect down here, and you say, aha, we'll just draw a line through here, and although to show an effect down here, to show this effect, it would take 9 million animals, or maybe 25 million animals, you see? That's out of the question, you see? So you have to say, well, to set the limits, we'll just adopt, for conservative reasons, a linear effect, and knowing that probably the effect is this way. Now, what happens then? People like Sternglass, who I told you about this morning, John Goffman and others, say, if you have a nuclear reactor, and up until rather recently, they said that you could have 100 I gotta make another step here to put this proper perspective for you. Well, I'll do that later. Let me say this, that there is no such a thing as a zero radiation dose. Here at Holden, you're probably getting a higher radiation dose than you are at home if you live in a wooden house, because there's probably quite a bit of granite around here. Are there geologists here? With granite and or brick houses, you're getting more radiation than other places. But overall, the average radiation dose that people are getting is 0.150 per year. I'm going to have more to say about that. That's rad or rem, or what we call 150 millirem. And in setting up the limits for reactors, they said, well, at the line, the people that are at the fence on a reactor, you can take double that and not worry about it. And so John Goffman, Dr. Goffman, and Art Tamplin says, in assaulting really Sternglass initially, said Sternglass is crazy. He says that if you have this kind of radiation dose and you assume linearity on leukemia, if you have this many reactors, you're going to lose maybe a couple of 100,000 people from leukemia. And Goffman Templin says he's crazy. He's made the wrong assumptions. You're not going to lose 200,000. You're only going to lose 30,000. You know, at leukemia. They didn't figure it right, and he made some assumptions. They, too, were using a linear extrapolation to assess the really leukemia cases, which is not really, I don't think, fair to do this. Now, we have done a good deal of work on this, and as some of you know, we have one study, for example, that involves 800 beagles for lifetime studies. And there's been a lot of mouse studies and so forth. We play a lot of games with the data, like a lot of people do. And we submitted, and it was accepted for the United Nations meeting. I told you about it last September, the United Nations meeting on peacetime use of nuclear energy. It caused a good deal of excitement. Applying a logistic in which we are plotting the effects of some of these radionuclides as far as their biological effect versus dose goes. And we find that, at least up until now, on essentially all that we have examined, the shape of the curve is sigmoid. And it also appears that in the radium patient. And we have this logistic, which is the growth equation for growth, really. It says it's more a logarithmic kind of a thing, and as you go to low doses, it says that we may expect to have a 10% incidence of osteogenic sarcoma in our radium group that it is approximately within a few, maybe a factor of two times the maximum permissible limit as set by the body I told you about that sets these limits, or suggests these limits, applied to the dog. Using this, you'd have a 10% incidence when the animal is 45 years of age, because it is a function not only of dose, but age and latency. In other words, if you have a high radiation dose, the time from the radiation to the time of the appearance of the tumor is less than if you have a low level radiation. If you go to very low levels of radiation, there's a good deal of repair, and so you will not see it in the during the lifetime of the animal. And you hear a lot of argument today about the so-called threshold dose, or some other term to describe this. I've got, there's been a lot of argument about this, and a lot of people say there's no such a thing as threshold dose. Any amount of radiation is damaging. But I won't contest that, except to say that the shape of the curve, as far as all the data that I'm familiar with, down at very low levels, you know, less than 25R, 10R, it is sigmoid in shape, so that there's less defect at very low levels. And we know from work within the last 15 years that even the DNA molecule, which some people say, you know, this is the coding in the gene, that there is repair within this, that the DNA does recognize an imperfection and has the ability to incise out and correct this and repair it. Now this was a remarkable finding. It was Settler by Settler at Oak Ridge in the late 50s, I guess it was. And we should have assumed this, because we have been exposed to radiation throughout the history of man, and probably higher radiation earlier than now. Some, in fact, suggest maybe it was radiation early that might have got some of these things going. But generally speaking, radiation is damaging. We have, of course, produced a lot of interesting mutations and some very interesting varieties of wheat and other grain crops by radiation, and producing interesting mutants that are, say, rust resistant or have some very desirable features that really end up being very profitable. But of the desirable mutations, they are far outweighed by the undesirable mutations. It's a little bit like taking my Rolex watch and you know, opening up the back cover and kind of poking around in there. The chances of improving it are rather remote compared with helping. But it's a little bit like this. So, but this is the crux of the argument in many places today as to whether it's linear or not. And we use linear when we assign, you know, the safety regulations and so forth. But in saying how many are going to be affected, you know, that isn't fair to frighten people with those kind of values, especially in the presence of the data we now have. All right, now let's look at sort of where we are on this. I've collected up a few of these. And to show you the difference in, I guess I can hold that down. I don't know if you can see this, though. Let me see. Can you see that? And this is just to show you that if you're on granite and at 10,000 feet, of course, your radiation dose, it's higher at higher altitudes because there's less filtering out of the cosmic rays from space. But you see here that if you're up there, you're getting 100 from cosmic radiation, and you're getting 17 from within the person, because we have, all of us have radioactivity within us. And then you're getting 90 up from the granite, so you're getting hit from both sides. And you're considerably over 200 millirads a year. And it shows here that if you go down in elevation, it's less. To give you some illustration of this, those are millirentgen per year.
Which is the same thing as an R, right?
Millirentgens are 1,000th of an R. Yeah. In other words, it's 100. It's I can keep it in R if you want, But most of our limits are set in millirentgens, so we'll stay with that. 1 R equals 1,000 millirentgens. So let's stay with that. And if you're on a lake, of course, there's less radiation coming up from below. But I was going to say that, say in Sacramento Valley, our mean or average background radiation there to people is about 150. Now, if you go to Denver, just going to Denver, 5,000 feet higher elevation, just going that distance, you're exposed to about 30 more millirentgens a year. And then if you climb, that's why I say when I ride in an airplane to Washington, which I have to do a lot, too much. You see, I take, on a short trip, I'll take 3 to 4 millirentgens on a round trip, which is more than I'm exposed to fallout in a year from the fallout that's accumulated so far. And it's about 1,000 times what you'd get if you're at the fence of the Dresden reactor. 1,000 times that. Pardon?
1,004?
What I get by riding an airplane, yeah. Mm-hmm. I know that comes as a shock to a lot of people, but for example, the Calvert Cliffs reactor. You know, there's a big to-do about this. In fact, it caused a great deal of problem, which I won't go into now because the ruling on it was such so that sort of changed the rules of the game. A lot of people didn't want the Calvert Cliffs reactor on the basis of its hazard, and they said it's all this tritium that you're going to release. There is considerable tritium released in it. But if you sat down and calculated out the tritium release to the Chesapeake by this thing, and if you figured that you drank all your water from the Chesapeake, and I certainly wouldn't recommend that, and if you got all your fish, you know, and you ate fish for all your protein, and got all your fish out of it, the gonad dose from that would be about 1/500 of what I get from one trip to Washington and back, in my gonad. To give you, put it in perspective for you. All right, now, and that's enough for that. You probably can't see this, but somebody, you know, looked at a lot of things, and I can tell you, this is some of the things I told you a little while ago, but cancer therapy, you know, in cancer therapy for some of this, you're talking, we can deal in millirentgens, and you might give 5 million millirentgens or millirad in some cancer therapy, not to the whole body, to partial body. Or you, and they bring out here the natural background. In Brazil, for example, I said the natural background in Sacramento and many other places is about 150 rad. Or 150 R. There are some places in the world, such as in Brazil, Kerala Sands in India, where the background is not 150 millirentgen, but it's 3,000 to 5,000 per year.
Why?
Because there is radioactive material in the sand. And the same in this country. The background in the Colorado Plateau, for example, because of the radiation in the ground, the higher amounts of radiation in the ground, uranium and other things, thorium deposits, the background in the United States varies. Some of it is up over 300 millirentgens a year. It's about double what we are in Sacramento Valley. I'll show you that.
Would you mind if I ask one more question?
No. Although this is a rather far-reaching question, the I think one of the points I'm trying to make here is that, and part of it here, you see this millirem per year, in various parts of the country, and you can look at them here, I guess we don't have any here over 300, but we got some at 245 in Wyoming. And it's as low as, what, 115 in Hawaii, 100 in Texas. Well, I'll be. But you see this variation, and we're dealing in a level which probably the body doesn't respond to, you know, or to really prove an effect, we could never run the experiment, you see, and added on to this, you see, there's just thousands and thousands of people who, you know, have been exposed to X-ray of various types, fluoroscopy in the chew machines and all other sorts of radiation. This is only the background radiation. Now, if I should do this, Mary, if I should take a population of animals and enlarge enough numbers, and if I radiate, put them in various radiation fields, so that they are damaged, and then you're selecting them, aren't you? So you might end up with a population that might be more resistant. I can't recall if the experiment has been done.
So your pig is saying 165% of the lethal dose.
No, what happens there is that, well, we don't fully understand it, but if I do something to you, or give you some kind of an assault, whether it's radiation or some other form, the irradiation will perturb your control system, in this case, say, the bone marrow. And it will damage a lot of cells so that you mess up the control system, so the control system says, we're short of those cells, let's get the system going. So you mobilize a lot of the cells to compensate for this, all right? So you're able then, mobilizing the thing, and sometimes you have an overshoot in response to this, so that if you're hit at that time, you're more resistant than a normal animal on a short-term basis. So you have a perturbed system. Now, here's some breakdown of the whole body. Is it radiation in nature? You know, you have a certain amount in food, and this is natural in the air, in buildings. I had a good slide today, but I didn't get time to show it. And so this shows you the breakdown of how they get 140 or 150 rentgen, millirentgen, I mean. And just in California, here's the kind of thing you see just on background. If you're here in San Francisco, you're running about 100 millirentgens. If you live in Marin County, there's a lot of granite here, you go up to 124, you see, a year, and over here and over here. This is just background radiation levels just from the ground and not considering medical X-ray. So you see this great variation. Let's see what else we got here. And this, yeah, this gives you some feel for this, all right? Of the average doses from radiation sources, you know, just the natural background we've been talking about is running, you know, 140, 150, and then medical dental, I mean, as an average, you know, you're getting that exposure, that adds another, could add another 80 or 100 and averaged out. Oh, excuse me, I should go like that, okay? Can everybody see that? All right. And the medical dental, not quite as much, but averaged out. Some people, of course, get a lot and some hardly at all. And then you have fallout. Now, we've, of course, been exposed to a lot of fallout. We're still getting a little bit. The Chinese and the French are still giving us a little bit, but not to the extent that we were getting it when both the Russians and the Americans were testing rather large devices on... shots that were vented to the atmosphere. And then occupational. In other words, if you're working around X-ray machines and all, or in nuclear industry, there's a little bit there, and nuclear power is contributing less than a tenth of a percent.
Now that means at the present time.
That's right. Yeah. Now, and that brings up an interesting thing. Now, the AEC has changed the limits on this. They've been operating that you can build reactors and have, you can figure that the people at the fence on the reactor maybe take up to 150, they can double the 150 average background dose per year, right? And you build a reactor to do that. You can go to that extent. Up until recently, you could do that. Well, a lot of those who were complaining about this said, well, that will double the leukemia incidence. You see, and this is the basis for a lot of this, these rather far out values on how many people would die from leukemia. And they'd multiply out this. The every man, woman, and child in the United States being exposed to 150 millirentgen extra, you'd have this many deaths. Well, there's a lot of fallacy in that. For one thing, there was no reactor in which you got any near this kind of an exposure. And in order to have everyone have 150 millirentgen extra exposure in the United States, you'd have to build a 1,000 megawatt reactor every 3 miles over the face of the United States, which isn't really within the realm of probability.
Who gets this exposure?
Well, nobody does.
So, I mean, with a nuclear reactor, who gets it?
Well, it's a function of distance from usually the windward side of the reactor and the type of reactor, but I imagine right now the limits are at 5 millirentgens a year. And I don't know if anybody has really gotten that. I think I have a couple of charts here that will show that. Because what happens on this, you see, that's a design criteria, and you build a fence around it, and you can't have anybody here. But usually you have quite an area in which there's low population, so that a few of the people there may be exposed to, maybe 3-4 millirentgens a year, but then you get, 25 miles away, and you don't know it.
And that's the same amount that you get in your one flight trip?
I get about 3 millirentgens to the gonads on the round trip before we fly at 38,000 feet.
What about the pilots?
Yeah, this is a very good question. I'm more interested in the stewardesses, but it's everyone for himself. But we suggested, my associate and I thought that this might be an interesting group to study, because because there are a lot of them, there's a lot of people that are flying, 800 hours a year in a much higher radiation dose, aren't they? Considerably. Because the truth of the matter is, it isn't that much more, but I don't think you'd see the effect. And you'd confuse it, because a lot of the pilots have been flying for a long time. Many of them were probably World War II. Some of the landings I've been taking recently were World War I. But they were exposed to tremendous amounts of radiation sitting in the cockpit, because they had radium dials on all their instruments. And the radiation dose that a lot of these pilots have taken is really very substantial on that, and just a lot more than what you get from that altitude. But a lot of people are doing epidemiological studies. For example, a lot of you could ask not only the pilots and stewardesses, but study the people who live, for example, in the Kerala Sands or down in Brazil, and they eat in Brazil nuts, which have high radium content. What about studying these people? Well, the problem with that is the effect that you might expect is obscured by all these other things. Just my going down there and saying a few kind words to the people in the Kerala Sands, would probably increase their lifespan. Or if I just give them if I shared my lunch with them, And what are you going to use for a control population? Because the noise level is so great. You understand? A lot of people say, well, why don't we compare the Denver population, where you've got a large number, with the population, say, in Sacramento, where the dose is considerably more than, not maybe almost twice as much. You should have twice as much leukemia and twice as much everything, I guess, huh? Well, there's a lot of problems with this. You've got to level out the smoking and all of that, and there's so many other things feeding into it, you'd never find the effect of radiation at that level, even if you could. Let me just show something to you. You because of all these other things. I think I have a chart here that might clarify or confuse this issue. Maybe.
Can I ask a question while you're
fumbling around here? Yes.
You mentioned the fact when you first started about a half hour ago that the measurement reports is one effect, but the types of radiation also, what you're getting bombarded with. Are you getting bombarded with an X-ray? Or are you getting bombarded with a neutron?
Yeah, this is a very important thing. Among other, the other radiobiological principles, we've already talked about fractionation. If you have a choice, in most cases, you can think of some exceptions, but we won't go into them. But generally speaking, if you're going to give me radiation, I'll say, just give it to me for 22 hours a day, spread over my lifetime. All right? That's far less. Another principle we talked about was the important is the where you take the radiation, whether it's whole body or partial body. The other one was the age. And another one, he brings up another one that's very important. What is the source of the radiation? Well, generally speaking, X-ray and cobalt are what we call their relative biological effectiveness. There are BE. It's about one. They're about the same. For neutrons, it's usually higher. If you're going to, and then you have to look at systems. If you're thinking about eyeballs, then the neutrons might be 10 to 20 times, depending on their energy, 10 to 20 times more effective for producing cataracts. If you're talking, up around 200 R. With the gonads, as far as an effect there, probably the RB would be somewhere, and maybe it's five times more effective. Alpha irradiation internally, they're a very heavy particle. It's really the helium nucleus, the alpha particle. And there, it's there again, there's some difference. You've heard me talk about strontium 90. If I take very soft X-ray, I can cause redness in your skin with 100 to 200 R. That is 200,000 milli-R. But if I use the gamma from cobalt, I might have to get up 600 to 1,000. Or the gamma out of radium, it would probably be 2,000 R exposure to get redness. Or if I use a strontium plaque from the beta particle, it isn't very long range, and it has to go through a few dead cells before it gets to the blood vessels and stuff, and that's around 2,000 rad. You see, so you have that difference. It's a very important thing. Now, for the reactor, yes?
Apart from redness, though, what about the total hostile effect on the living
body? And that's an important thing, all right? It is to an extent, the tumor that might be formed, you probably have a higher incidence of tumor if you have tissue damage. All right? Now, if I take that soft irradiation right here on my abdomen, that soft irradiation doesn't penetrate. So I won't expect much effect inside, say over my whole abdomen. So I probably maybe prefer to take, at my age, I would prefer to take the very soft radiation. I could go along with that redness. I'd rather do that than take over my home abdomen a penetrating radiation like cobalt 60 or something like that, you see, because the effect is, there's a lot of other tissue hit by that, and the latency for skin irradiation for producing tumors is quite long in skin. I should point that out to you, that in the Hiroshima and Nagasaki population, well, one of the few things that you do see, that we've seen, is an increased incidence in leukemia, and that was visible within 3 years after radiation. That's about the shortest latency of any tumor I knew of, radiation-induced, in man. With skin irradiation, I know of one case where it was a 55-year latency. The woman was irradiated. There was good records kept. She had, in the early days of X-ray development, she had had a kidney problem as in her youth, and they, for some reason, exposed her to a good deal of radiation. I guess they were taking pictures, but in the process, because they had a lot of soft radiation that wasn't filtered out in those days as it is now, and they had a very bad burn right here over a kidney, and they made a good record of it, and a scar there. And right in that location, 55 years later, she developed cancer there. So the latency in skin tumor is quite long. You know, we think of a 15 to 50 years or something. With bone cancer, maybe it's 10 to 15. Thyroid tumors, it's about that.
Let me ask one more clarifying question. What is the kind of radiation then that comes from the nuclear reactor?
Yeah, that's what I was going to get to. That's a very good point. And unfortunately, the tritium, of all the elements that we deal with, tritium has the highest maximum permissible limit. If you're going to drink 100 microcuries of something, tritium wouldn't be a bad one, and drink a lot of water and beer afterwards, and it'll flush out. That's a lot better than, say, strontium. Some of it will be absorbed, go to bone, and stay there for a very long time, and it has a half-life of a biological half-life of many years, and the physical half-life of strontium is 28 years. There is the possibility of some radioiodine, although that's very well controlled, and in the Dresden reactor they have not been able to find any radioiodine in any of the animals around there. And they check the thyroids of all the animals, you see, and it concentrates the radioiodine remarkably. And then it's krypton, which is kind of like a whole body radiation dose, but it's mainly a beta emitter, so it's like being submerged in it. And it doesn't have it's better than taking neutrons, you know. Or even better, I'd rather take it in X-ray. Xenon to an extent, and that again is a noble gas and not absorbed. That's pretty much the main ones from a reactor. Now, when you talk separation plants, that's something else.
Tritium was the perhaps most.
Tritium and krypton. We're going to build up on krypton.
Tritium is not.
Well, tritium, of course, is absorbed, and this is why it works like hydrogen. But you also have a turnover in hydrogen. You take it in this tritium oxide, which is tritiated water.
It doesn't stay around long in your body.
Yeah, it has a relatively short half-life, except for a small component where it maybe gets wound up with a fat.
But Hiroshima, those were all hard radiations.
Well, in Hiroshima, you see, most of that dose was not from isotopes, but from the neutrons and gamma of the explosion. And the same for the Marshallese people, that 175R, mainly a penetrating radiation. And the neutrons, and you see in the difference in effect between the Nagasaki and the Hiroshima population, because in one there was a great deal more neutrons than in the other. Neutrons, if you have a choice, don't take neutrons. Unless you're going to use it for therapy for cancer, and there's quite a development now in utilizing high-energy neutrons for cancer therapy, and there's some rather promising results.
That's specific.
specifically.
Yeah, yeah, you've got to know what you're doing. Now this is a very interesting thing here, to compare the effects, say, of a radiation with other hazards, and talking about, say, the people in Denver and other places. Let me see, I think that I have it here. I can probably do better than this by just writing on here, but I've run out of paper. Let's just see what he says. Now, using a linear extrapolation, this fellow says, this is the lifetime lost due to average environmental external whole body radiation and other conditions. And they're using the maximum permissible dose here. And everybody is allowed. They usually figure that you shouldn't have more than a half an R a year. This is independent of this nuclear reactor I'm talking about. And we feel that you can take a half of an R per year and really not show an effect. But let us say that cosmic rays only at sea level. I'm figuring now a linear extrapolation on the shortening of lifespan. You'll lose, they say, 22 days by 65 years. Or if your extra loss due to living at 5,000 feet elevation is about 11 days. Over sedimentary rock outdoors at sea level, 50. If you have a brick or concrete house, you lose a couple of hundred days. From the fallout, you lose about 1.2 days. And now compare with, say, city versus country living. If you live in the city, you lose about 5 years versus the country. If you're not married, you lose about 5 years. No, they're not a threat because if you're not married, it's far worse. Oh. You gain 5 years if you're married. Let's put it that way.
Oh, that's different.
Huh? But I told the guy that evolved that, I says, boy, you better be careful with that information because my observation has been that it depends on who you marry. All right? You lose about 5 years if you're 25% overweight. Is that right? Or is it 3.6? Yeah, if you're not very active, if you're just sitting around getting a waffle butt, you lose about 5 years. If you're smoking one pack a day, you lose about 9 years. If you're smoking two packs a day, I think you lose about 15 or 20. Insulin-controlled diabetes is about 10 years less, the life expectancy. Let me see, male versus female. The female lives usually average 3 years longer. And in other words, what this says, and the Swedes live longer, and the Norwegians live longer, and it says that if you're a woman in rural Sweden with children and is also married, you will have a life expectancy that will be about 30 years longer, 30 or 40 years longer, than an overweight bachelor living in Brooklyn, smoking two packs a day and 20% of gold. And you're talking years down here with these various inputs, you see, compared with a few days, even if you use the worst possible case on life shortening. This is what I'm trying to get across here, and that's what he's trying to get across. You understand the relative effects of the various noise levels and the toxins that you're exposed to. I'm sorry that I didn't get any further because I wanted to mention now the SO2. There's been some estimates on SO2, but I can do that in about 5 minutes in the morning. Okay? And then we'll talk about, I think we should then go right into overpopulation. And I think you folks should take some of that. I can give you a few things. I can kind of introduce some of the overpopulation. But then we can get an overpopulation. Huh? Is that all right?
What about the thermal effects?
All right, maybe we better mention thermal effects. All right. We can have some discussion. There's a lack of quantitative data. Pardon?
Why don't you do that tomorrow, too? So many people on TV.
Yeah.
What about what we're getting out of the fossil fuels already?
As far as damaging stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to get to that next. Yeah, the SO2 and all of that. And I have a few charts on it. So we'll discuss that tomorrow. Tomorrow at 9.
What's
SO2? Yeah, sulfur dioxide. You see, from burning, unlike the nuclear plants, from burning any of the hydrocarbons, you use oil and the coal and all of that, you get sulfur dioxide, the oxides of nitrogen, certain particulate material, some of which isn't yet defined, CO, carbon monoxide, but that's more from cars, and probably an increase in CO2, all of which have a deleterious effect. And unbeknownst, and I'll repeat it tomorrow, unbeknownst to a lot of people, a lot of the coal-burning plants release more radioactivity to the environment than the nucleus.
What about the nitrogen oxide?
The oxides of nitrogen, yeah. Yeah, they're a problem here. Yeah. Huh? Yeah.
Do you recall that that small town in Colorado that was there was housing development?
Yes, yes, this is yes, I
have.
Oh, a few millirentkins a year, I guess. There's a lot of
it wasn't significant.
Well, I don't think they'll ever see an effect with it. But it's something they shouldn't have done, you know. You don't expose yourself to any radiation. You don't have to. And they discouraged them from doing this, but they said, boy, that's good sand, and we'll just build with it, see? And they just went ahead and done it. And they shouldn't have done it. They were told not to.
What has come of this? What sort of important events have taken place since this?
Well, I haven't had the latest on that, because I have not...
Medically, what have they done?
Oh, well, what... Some people have made a study, a very poor epidemiological study of that area, and said that there's been an increase in infant mortality. But there again, you see, it's such a small population. You have to look at the age of the mother, and which they haven't done, and you know, it's all goofed up, and you can never prove anything with the population you got.
They're still living there.
Yeah, as far as I know.
Going back to the Minnesota deal.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, I read a paper that about putting the waste in the Mississippi River.
Yeah, because there is release of tritium into it. Yeah.
Have there been accidents, or has this been
no, there is
regularly, or what?
Yeah, depending on the type of reactor, but there is considerable radioactive release into the effluent stream, and this is programmed in. As long as you stay within a certain limit. You're allowed a certain amount to be released.
How about the fusion? Will that just cure the whole problem?
Not fully. You weren't there this morning.
No, I'm
all right. Not. All right. We discussed fusion this morning. And a lot of people say, well, why don't we go to fusion? Because that will solve all our problems. You have unlimited source of fuel. It's clean. It isn't going to blow up. It can't be sabotaged to blow up. Because I haven't gone into that on the fission type thing, because you can sabotage a reactor of the kind we have now, but you can't really sabotage much with cause much damage in the fusion. So there are a lot of advantages, but there are some serious disadvantages. But it isn't completely free of radioactivity, because there's a lot of tritium there, much more tritium, but because there's so much and you have to produce it, it's going to be economical, of course, to recover it. So there won't be so much loss of that, but there's going to be some radiation from it, and you're going to have induced radiation, because whenever you have neutrons entering any kind of a metal or material, there is induced radiation, whether it's to you or anybody else. I can tell, for example, I could just check your blood and your gold teeth after an exposure to neutrons, and I'll tell you how much dose you got, because there's induced radioactivity in here.
There are other, is that fusion based on some kind of a steam transporting process
of
getting the energy into our system? Aren't they speculating with different ways of getting the energy
produced
in the fusion
system? Well,
is that strictly a
transfer? Well, there are various methods looked at and proposed, but it's pretty much, you know, you're producing the heat, a lot of heat, and you've got to get it into a steam to produce it.
But, Leo, but there's no fusion things. There's no fusion reactors right now, are there?
No. And that's
it's
the
not
big
even
thing.
Known how to do, right?
We do not know how to produce a controlled fusion reaction. We know how to produce a thermonuclear bomb, and that's a fusion reaction, but it's, you know, like that. We know how to do that, and well, we are as good as anybody in the world. But the Chinese are also quite good, and so are the Russians.
Is there a fusion reaction involved in the reaction?
No. no fission involved in the fusion reaction, none at all. No fission products at all, but there are this induced radioactivity, there's a release of radiation from the actual process, and you're going to have some tritium loss. Yeah, you use the ostensibly you use a fission bomb to be the detonator for the fusion reaction, because you can get a lot of heat that way. Because in order to see on my lecture this morning, what you have, the problem in a fusion reaction are these. You have to get to a temperature of 100 million degrees. And you have to get a lot of tritium and deuterium, so the nucleuses together in a, what we call a plasma. And you have to contain it for at least a second. And our problem is to get to that temperature, to get enough of the material in the plasma, and the big problem, which I didn't mention this morning, is to keep from losing the plasma. And the way you, of course, there's no container for something that you keep at 100 million degrees, so you use many millions of gauze of magnetic field. And so there are really big technical problems. We have to make some quantum jumps in our technology to get there. But how do you predict it? You don't know what some of these geniuses are coming up with. One of the more recent ones I didn't mention this morning, you've all heard about the remarkable invention of laser beam. Well, you know, you can... Lasers are now being developed as instruments of war, as some of you may know. But it will burn a hole at a long distance. You can get remarkable heat. And there's been a recent finding, fairly recent, and now I guess unclassified, that by using laser beams into pellets of tritium and deuterium, you are going to be able to get rather remarkable temperatures. But they don't know if that's the way, if they're going to make it go that way, but it's a possibility.